Time for another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today, and great to have back Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, professors of horticulture at the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, and we like to call them the Vicars of Vegetables. So we'll talk about some great new cultivars. Jim had a double AS winner. We'll talk with him about that. It happened a year or two ago.
Oh, good. Can I promote some sales?
You will be able to.
Okay, great. Thank you.
But we'll also be taking gardening questions as well. So maybe you have a problem with your veggies this year, or maybe it's going great. Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Somebody asked me, how did they get the name of the Vicars of Vegetables? And if I recall, we had a listener suggestion contest. Remember that, Erwin?
I do.
Yeah, and we had many names. Some were not allowed to say on the air.
Yeah.
Some were not allowed to say
some of
the air.
Some of the folks who actually know us personally suggested some that we felt were very inappropriate. Yeah.
So anyway, we picked that, and the haikus were inspired by you, Jim. You're a haiku guy.
I'm just into poetry in general. Right?
And I think the vegetables further inspire you.
Yeah, and vegetables. I mean, it's all about. I mean, they are in a real sense. Vegetables are culinary poetry.
I would agree. And can you lay one on us?
Well, here's one I found on a website, Larry, that I think exemplifies exactly what Jim just said. This is a haiku about the parsnip, and here it is: cook them in a pan. Saute until they are brown. # parsnip love.
There you go.
They inspire people, right? You know, they just say, who would have met
anybody
except for the wild
parsnip.
Yeah, the wild parsnip is a little toxic. But I mean, you know, think about that, the simple beauty of the parsnip. And think about a cooked parsnip that inspired somebody to write
I think that's really the essence of vegetables. I mean, they are created by us. I mean, there aren't – if you went back millennia, you know, you wouldn't find, you know, giant tomatoes growing in the tropics.
No.
They're our creations.
We made them.
But there's a simplicity and beauty about vegetables that, you know, that just transcends.
Right. Well, what about peppers? You've got one on peppers.
Oh, well, of course, I'm into the hot pepper.
Yes. See,
because, as you know, right, I consider eating hot peppers to be the vegetable equivalent to falling in love. Because, you know, I mean, because what happens when you fall in love? You kind of get that flush, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, your heart is kind of pounding a little bit. There's some sweating. Do you remember that? And I personally remember a great deal of pain.
which was characteristic of your dating career.
That was my dating career. Mm-hmm. In fact, yeah, it was always and the exiting line was always, "You're so nice, but now I won't go out with you." So, in that sense, ladies and gentlemen, isn't eating hot peppers the vegetable equivalent to falling in love? And those of you who have not, you know, experienced the pain, you've never really fallen in love. Anyway, here's the haiku.
Okay.
Love is a pepper. Its heat lingers on the lips long after the kiss.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That is a good. And did you come up with that all by yourself?
Of course. This is what I do in my office. A lot of people think I'm napping. But in fact, you know, I don't. I take a professorial nap, you know, a little later in the afternoon. But a lot of people think I'm napping. Right now, I'm thinking about poetry.
Beautiful.
Well, we have All-American Selection winners, double AS we call them, for 2020.
How come they're not triple AS?
That's the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
That's why.
Oh, I'm not a member of that. I've never even thought about that.
But,
okay.
But what is the AA?
Jim, you have a recent All-American Selection winner. The Ahi Rico pepper.
Yeah, you know they any breeder, any public or private breeder, you can you can send your line in, send in, you have to send in like 50 packages of 50 seeds each, and they'll test them all over the United States, and people will rate them at those locations, and the ones that they find the most superior, you know, they're looking for broad adaptation mm-hmm. as well. I mean, that's an important criteria for them. Although they do have some regional winners, you know, the national winners have this broad adaptation, and the companies, the seed companies pay attention to this because, you know, obviously if there's a line of something that is, you know, widely adapted and is viewed favorably by the AAS judges, it can, you know, it can promote sales. So we submitted our we've been working for many years on a line on an ahi pepper. This is a slightly different species. Most 99% of the peppers are Capsicum annuum. This is a pepper from Peru, and if you go to the beach there, like if you have ceviche, you know,
yeah,
like and a cold beer, mm-hmm. you know, like you will get a little, you will get some the, you will get a little jar of you know ahi, right, and that's what you put into your ceviche to give it a little oomph,
kick,
yeah, mm-hmm. a little bit of a kick. Anyway, we've been working on this pepper, and we made one. I love it. It's, you know, it's, it has wonderful flavor. It has wonderful texture. You know, it has, it's aromatic. The trouble is it was simply too long a season mm-hmm. for Wisconsin. So our goal was to make it shorter season, and that's what we did. And it, so it has bright red, large fruit, and it's early maturing, and it, it won the AAA award. And for $29.95, ladies and gentlemen. And we will throw in some steak knives. You know, you can get that set of steak knives and your Ahi Rico.
But that right? pepper is, if I remember right, that pepper Pan American Seed, right? Is the is are they the
they it was sent
they I were the seed ball, company the, ball seed ball seed.
The yeah. only company that paid any attention whatsoever, mm-hmm. right, was Ball Seed
ball
out of
seed.
Chicago.
Yeah,
they were looking for, you know, they were looking for sort of oddball stuff because mm-hmm. they wanted to create a market for what they called gourmet, mm-hmm. gourmet vegetables. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking for things that were a little out of the ordinary.
Nice.
And Irwin, if there's anything that describes me, it is slightly out of the ordinary.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Jim Dionuse and Irwin Goldman, our guests today, professors of horticulture in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Question or maybe a haiku for them. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. So, and this is the year of the beet, and I didn't see a beet in the AAAS winners.
Right. But it's unfortunate, but it is true, Larry. The National Garden Bureau has named this the year of the beet. And from my point of view, it's about time. The
well,
year
you're
of the
a beet guy.
I'm a beet lover.
Couldn't it be the decade of the beet? Really? I mean, why just a simple year? Well,
I couldn't agree more. But it's great to see a vegetable like that be celebrated. It is a beautiful vegetable that is undergoing a kind of a renaissance.
Yeah.
I mean, there is more and more interest in this vegetable year by year. And I think people – and it's true for many of the simple root vegetables that people have rediscovered these sort of – these very flexible foods that can be used in so many different dishes.
What about the pigments, Irwin?
I mean, I
love beets, but you know, the entire kitchen and part of the living room is just stained red. You know, I mean,
right.
What's the deal there?
It's an issue. And the problem when you cook red beets with other foods, right, is that it does color the whole dish.
You mean they tend to dominate a bit?
They dominate. I mean, okay, I would say that there would be ways to manage it. One way would be to roast the beets and then to take those roasted chunks or roasted sections and combine them later with other foods. So you could make roasted root vegetable dish in which you'd combine them afterwards, and then you don't have the mess. Another thing you could do would be to use the yellow beet, which bleeds less, has less color. But,
oh, really?
But you have identified a social problem.
But I can tell you that the beet grilled –
yes.
I don't think there's anything better, and it's we've grilled it with other vegetables, and the color doesn't go off onto the other vegetables.
How do you do it, Larry?
Whole.
Yeah, how do you?
Just a little oil on, you know, cut them up a little bit, put a little oil on them, and they get so sweet. Mm-hmm. The first time I had them, I thought, well, this is not going to work. They're a couple of grilling magicians were doing this, and he said, oh, you just wait and see. So we had all these different vegetables out there, including the beet in there, and not the beet. Well, I had a couple of pieces of that beet, and then I go back to get more of the beet, and I find that people had picked the beet out of every – they were all gone. And they just get so much sweeter. There's
right. They concentrate the sugars. And you know, what you just said, Larry, is so meaningful in a way. If you think about a bunch of kids and being forced to eat beets, that's the last thing they pick out, right?
Yeah.
And imagine people seeking them out because they're so sweet and good. And I think that's what people are rediscovering about this vegetable.
How about grilling the rutabaga? Is there any possibility there that can anyone comment on that out there in our listening audience?
Look, yeah, it would be interesting to hear about grilling. I mean,
and, of course, grilled asparagus.
Grilled asparagus, fantastic.
And may I ask, as I was bicycling over here, I ran – the window washers were in my office, although they said my windows were spotless, really, because my office is so clean. And they asked why when we eat asparagus does our urine have a somewhat penetrating odor?
You know, that is one of the great vegetable questions of all time. And I mean, I think for years there was a sort of a snobbery about this, but the answer to this question. People said, well, you know,
not me.
That doesn't happen to me. Maybe that's a problem for you. But it in recent years, people have discovered that, and by the way, we should say that it's the asparagusic acid in asparagus. There's a compound called asparagusic acid, which gets transformed in your body into a whole suite of sulfur-based chemicals that have a very unpleasant smell. And it turns out that what is variable about us is our ability to detect those compounds. But in fact, we all produce them. So we all differ in our ability to smell them, but we all produce them when we eat asparagus.
So the snobs are actually somewhat inferior in a genetic sense.
I think that's true. And it turns out that this is an interesting thing about eating in general that we're learning, a scientific fact that so much of our perception of vegetables, fruits, the things that we eat have to do with our sensory receptors, and because we humans vary so much in the quality and the number of those receptors, our taste perceptions differ for those reasons.
This brings up the conversation we were having in the truck while we were driving up to plant a trial at Hancock. The students were asking me about, you know, the difference between cilantro and culantro.
That is so interesting.
And
what is culantro?
Well, culantro, I mean, some people think it's just, you know, a bad, you know, pronunciation of a word. But in fact, culantro is a plant, you know, in the same family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it produces very similar aldehydes to cilantro. So, in fact, they have almost identical flavor, although the plants themselves...
They look so different?
Look so different because cilantro, right, cilan, with the C-I, is a European, right, Asian vegetable that was introduced into the Americas. Culantro is native to Mesoamerica, and it is used as a flavoring as well. In fact, my wife... one of the problems with cilantro is that it can't take high temperatures. It'll turn dark, right? So it's always something that's added after the dish is prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas culantro...
You can put it right in.
You can put it right in your black beans and flavor them. But they both have remarkably similar flavor. It's due to these aldehydes. And again, it's one of these compounds that somewhere between, depending on your ethnic group, between 4 and 14% or something like that of the population... detects those aldehydes as
soap
and rotting insects.
Right.
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 And the other, you know, 80% of the population detects it as, you know, fresh and crispy.
Exactly.
And it's all about our, it's not about the, you can't blame the vegetable.
Yeah.
It's all about us and it's, our in the variation in our receptors.
Jim Nienhuis and Irwin Goldman, our guest today, professors of horticulture at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll get to Susan in Milwaukee and Tracy in Sheboygan in just a second here, but want to remind you as well that Dave Potratz is our engineer, Jane Rotunda, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Jim Nienhuis and Irwin Goldman, professors of horticulture. We know them as the vicars of vegetables. So we're zeroing in on vegetables and a little on haikus as well as we visit with them. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. We've got Susan in Milwaukee, then we'll go to Tracy. But first, Susan, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I'm another beet lover.
Good.
And I particularly like beets as they're pickled, but I have never mastered the best ratio of sugar, vinegar, and water. Do you know those? That my an answer to those perplexing ingredients.
Jim, what ratios do you use?
I don't remember the exact ratios I used. However, I will say that one of the things that I did that really made an outstanding pickled beet, I mean, there are a lot of, I think on the internet you'll find, you know, these, you know, the recipes. But what I did was I added some white wine. Yeah, a little white wine. You know, give those, because, you know, beets have almost everything except, you know, sort of that je ne sais quoi. They do not have that, and white wine provides that.
Well, I think wine would be terrific. I mean, I would say a typical recipe, if you were thinking about, you know, let's think about a quantity of beets that's about a pound.
Okay.
I don't know how much you'd be using, but let's say it's a pound, maybe a half a cup of vinegar to a pound of beets, maybe about half that amount of sugar. So let's quarter cup of sugar and a very small amount of salt. I would say a very tiny, a fraction of a teaspoon of salt would be the ratios that I would use.
Yeah, would you
throw in a full cup of white wine?
No, you wouldn't put like a tablespoon of white wine?
I don't know. I've never tried that, but maybe. I mean, we're talking about a tiny amount of salt. Maybe would you do a teaspoon or a tablespoon of wine?
No. No, I go beyond that.
Okay.
And it just added, I don't know, added kind of a unique flavor to the beet, I thought.
All right. Yeah.
Kind of fun.
Very nice. Try
your recipe with and without, and you can make a decision as to which one you like.
But try about a quarter cup
of sugar
in that recipe and about a half of vinegar.
All right.
See how that works for you.
Susan, does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Tracy in Sheboygan. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. I have a haiku.
Good. What have you got for us? What's it about?
Well, it's about a pepper, a purple pepper.
Oh, wow. Nice.
All right. Well, let's hear it.
Dog opens fridge door, observes all that is stored there, ripe purple pepper.
Ooh, the dog was not happy, probably.
Well, you know how dogs always stick their face in the fridge door no matter what's in there? Well, that's what my dog was doing when I got inspired to write this poem about the purple pepper that happened to be there.
Oh, Tracy, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. You know, Adele emailed in a haiku as well. She said, I planted an egg. Water, soil, sun, and loving. Where are the eggplants?
Okay, that's fair.
That's fair. Okay. Kyle in Dunn has something for us. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I planting garlic is one of my favorite things to do, and I completely forgot to do it last fall. So I bought some heads from a garden store and had some shipped in from Washington, and some soft neck varieties, hard neck varieties, whatever. And they're looking okay, but they haven't formed clothes. They're just kind of like a golf ball, maybe a racquetball size.
When did you plant
them? I'm just wondering, will that store?
When did you plant them?
I planted them late April, May.
I wouldn't think so. I mean, because typically you'd have to have some fall planting and a little bit of growth there to make something substantial enough to store. Jim, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think don't worry about the cloves so much. Well, worry about the scapes, right?
You could eat the scapes.
Yeah. I mean, I would focus on the scapes.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not produce, you know, very large cloves, right?
Yeah.
But I think they're undoubtedly, both the long neck and the hard neck, they're both going to produce the scapes. And
somebody's going to say, what are scapes?
What are scapes?
Scapes are the flowering stalks that you'll see of those garlic plants coming up. And they're wonderfully twisty and turny, and they are just delicious.
Why are they so delicious?
You know, they contain all these fabulous compounds that the garlic and the onion contain, and those savory sulfur compounds that we go for. And you could saute them just like you were doing other garlic or onion.
Okay.
They're fantastic. I mean, I think that would be wonderful for Kyle. I think your question was about whether the cloves themselves will store. That part I'm not sure about. I'm not sure if you'll get substantial enough cloves to store.
Yeah. That.
Any ideas on what I could do for – I mean, I have probably 200 golf ball-sized heads of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, like, canning or freezing an option?
Absolutely. You could certainly eat them. You know, you could certainly consume them. If your question was whether you'll be able to get them through a very long period of time, that's something it's hard to know. But you could absolutely pickle them. You could dry them. You could consume them. All of that would
freeze
be great.
Freeze them? Would you freeze them?
I wouldn't freeze them.
Canning
although
is great.
You could can
and
them.
Some white wine. It's kind of a theme I've got now in canning. But the little white wine, you know, come on, imagine. Canned. I mean, you can peel those.
They're beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Peel those garlic cloves, clean off all those that outer leaf, and then
love it.
Have a jar full of those with a little white wine pickled. That's great.
I was thinking about just chopping up some of the garlic and then putting them in ice cube trays.
Yeah.
And then just put water in there, and then you freeze them. And
that works beautifully. And, you know, we've started using that in our house, the frozen garlic preparation, where you just push it out of the ice cube tray. It's a really nice way to cook. It makes it so much easier.
Yeah, makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, love it.
So those are some ideas, Kyle. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Kent in Washburn up next. Hi, Kent.
Hi. Well, I don't have any haiku, but I've got a couple of vegetable poems I could share with you.
Okay, let's hear them.
Acceptable.
Okay. Well, I'll start with asparagus. Hail to these green shoots of the earth, whose virile erections sanctify with godly humor our most holy and earthy uniting.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. That makes it sound so much nicer than the smelly urine. You know, I think I had fears that he might go in that direction, but he did not. He took a high road.
Took the high road. Kent, you had another one?
Yeah, I was. I've got potato.
Okay.
You want me to read potato?
What's that?
I was starting to read the potato poem.
Okay. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I've watched you grow tall and green, shooting forth your small white flowers while your best work is going on in secret, as little globes of white begin to light the underground sky. Pouring your life into these hidden offspring, you wither and die, and still I wait. And now at last comes the day of reckoning, as I eagerly push aside the sheltering soil to see what you've accomplished this year. That's it.
Did you write these or?
Yeah.
Boy,
you know.
Good,
I mean,
Kent.
I would have to say that the line "lighting the underground sky," I think that is direct.
That's beautiful.
I mean, you could be Neruda. I mean, that is like Pablo Neruda, isn't it?
Would you be able
we
to
need
post
that posted.
Them?
Kent, can you email that to us at ideas@wpr.org, or would you be willing to do that? Light the underground sky. I love that.
Neruda would have written that. But Paul did already.
Thank you again. I appreciate it very much. Well, Matt in St. Croix Valley has a suggestion for us. Hi, Matt.
Hi. In the words of Pablo Neruda, tell me something beautiful from your island. Patricia Russo.
Oh, we miss you.
It was from Il Postino. Patricia Russo was something beautiful from the island.
Yes, okay.
Anyway, sorry. You're rocking Neruda. Anyway, back to Kyle. So I plant garlic too.
Yep.
And I missed harvesting some last year. And then all of a sudden this year, because I didn't plant any last year either, by mistake, this year I had a bunch more garlic, all the garlic that I didn't harvest. So I would say harvest half of what you have, Kyle, leave the other half and see what happens next. Mm.
That's not a bad idea either.
Because it'll overwinter.
Yeah, right? it'll probably overwinter fine.
That's a great suggestion.
Nice
Thanks,
idea.
Matt. Yeah,
nice idea.
Appreciate it very much.
And that could be another opportunity to light the underground sky.
There we go.
I'm kind of enamored with that. You know?
Yeah. Nice. Thanks, Matt. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Cheryl in Conover, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cheryl.
I absolutely am enjoying everything about you and your guests today. It's wonderful.
Oh, thanks, Cheryl.
Usually the ratings drop.
I'm a proponent of chard. I absolutely adore chard.
Oh, how nice to hear.
It was because of my CSA, Evergood Farm, in Sugar Camp, Wisconsin, that got me turned on to chard. And I take it, put it in, I rough chop it, put it in a frying pan with olive oil and chipotle vinegar, or like your guest said, I could see some wine in there too.
Yeah.
And I saute it up. I even put a little pat of butter in there. And I even get my husband, who doesn't eat vegetables, to eat it. He loves it. We love it. We could live on it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That is beautiful to hear. It is such an... Don't you think it's an underappreciated vegetable? People just don't know about Swiss chard.
Yes, and I think that what helped us to understand Swiss chard is the fact that we were fortunate enough to have a CSA group who helped us learn about the different vegetables we would be getting in our CSA.
Mm-hmm. Erwin, what is the origin of the Swiss part of the chard?
That's true. It is a bit unusual, right, that it has a country name in it.
Yeah.
but, you know, chard comes from, it really is the original form of the beet was a leafy plant that looked like Swiss chard. It was only later that humans selected a swollen root out of Swiss chard that became the beet. The chard was the original Roman salad vegetable.
So it has nothing to do. I thought it might have something to do with like the Rolex or something like that. But no, I mean, I was thinking, but that's not there.
Nothing about Swiss banking or Swiss watches. Okay.
It's chard.
It's later on, many centuries later, as the chard plant moves out of the Mediterranean basin and in throughout Europe, that it gets popular in Northern Europe. Because it is really it does well in a cool season.
And she's sauteing this with a little white wine.
Yeah, she had some chipotle vinegar in there.
Chipotle vinegar. That's
a fantastic.
Cheryl, what was that recipe again that you had for the chard?
Okay, I put a little olive oil in the frying pan.
Okay.
And I put the chard in first, the Swiss chard.
Is it whole or chopped?
Rough chopped.
Rough chopped.
Rough chopped. And then I sprinkle the top of it with chipotle vinegar, saute it down till it's wilted a little bit, and take it off, and we eat it as a vegetable.
But then once in a while, you throw a little butter on top.
Yeah, actually, I'll put a pat of butter in it just to give it that kind of, it's almost like a sweeter, more savory flavor.
Yeah.
But we love it. In fact, I have a container of it in my refrigerator right now because I didn't want the Swiss chard to spoil. I wanted to get it cooked. And we love it with a really nice steak. It's really good with a ribeye on the side, a big serving of chard and steak, and then you have a keto diet.
we overlooked the white wine here a little bit. Maybe what about a Wollersheim Prairie Fumé?
Oh, yeah, very nice.
Doesn't Prairie Fumé like go with every vegetable?
It does. It would be perfect with that.
Cheryl, because she has this, you can sense that she has a culinary instinct. Cheryl, can you help me personally work on what would be a great recipe for the summer squash? Because they're coming in like gangbusters right now, and
they are.
And people are, you try to give them away, and then people just, they want, they
they run.
Yeah, they run, and sometimes they utter, inappropriate things, And I'm thinking if I could say to them, Cheryl provided me with a summer squash mm-hmm. recipe, try this. What would you say to them, Cheryl?
I have one. Right
okay,
now.
God bless you. You're there.
Exactly. I can tell you exactly what to do with summer squash.
Oh, boy. Okay. Oh, boy. I'm ready.
Okay. Take your summer squash. Cut the ends off.
Okay.
Chop it in sticks, like carrot sticks, like the long sticks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they'll be like a foot long.
No. You can cut the squash in half and then cut it in sticks.
All right.
Okay?
All right.
Cut it in sticks. Then... put it on your grill and just grill it real quick, then bring it back in the house, and here is the recipe. It's balsamic vinegar, a little bit of sugar, and any of the seasonings you might like I like basil or rosemary. Thyme I wouldn't put in, but rosemary is really good with it. Mix up some balsamic vinegar, olive oil, rosemary, and toss the squash in the mixture and serve the squash. And it is scrumptilious.
Oh, wow. I'm doing it tonight. I'm going to do it tonight, Cheryl.
That's wonderful.
It.
You had something about beets as well, didn't you, Cheryl?
Oh, yes. You know what I had for dinner last night?
No.
Beets. For dinner and a bowl of ice cream for dessert.
was the ice cream put on top of the beet? Actually, was that?
No.
I'm getting
the beets were in butter. The beets were in butter in a bowl. I just boil them, cut them up, smother them in butter, and eat an entire huge bowl of beets for dinner,
and then a bowl of ice cream. And what about
my husband looked at
Cheryl? The only thing we're missing out here is that Prairie Fumé. Any possibility?
Oh, yeah. Well, that I can drink. Yeah,
okay,
drink that in a glass on the side.
All right, I'm going to try your recipe: the balsamic vinegar, a little touch of a little sugar, toss it with a little
olive oil,
don't
rosemary. Forget the olive oil.
Okay, I'm going to try it with cilantro.
Don't forget your seasoning.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All right.
Cilantro would be very good. Cilantro would be delicious.
Cilantro. I'm going to go for the cilantro. Not the culantro, but the cilantro.
Cheryl, thank you very much. And, Irwin, the whole history of the beet.
Where does she live? I want to live next to her.
That's great.
It's fantastic. I think that it relates to something Jim talks frequently about, that vegetables are really things that humans have had such a huge role in creating. These are not necessarily plants that you'd find in nature. So while the Swiss chard might actually be like a plant one would find in nature, like a leafy green,
yeah.
The beet itself was something humans selected when they needed to get through the winter. You know, so yeah. they selected a swollen root, and this is the story of vegetables intertwined with humans.
Yeah, it's amazing. Cheryl, thank you again. Lots of fun talking with you. Carol in Sister Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I have a recipe for a brine for pickled beets.
All right. Ah,
fantastic.
Well, of course, you have to boil your beets and skin them and then keep them hot. You cut them in chunks if they're too big and keep them hot in your oven, in a warm oven, while you prepare the jars and all that. You use 2 cups of sugar, 3 cups of water, 2 cups of vinegar, and 1 teaspoon of whole allspice,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of cinnamon sticks, and a teaspoon of whole cloves, and just a very little salt in each pint as you fill it, and mm-hmm. it makes... this is a brine, and it depends on how many beets you're going to pickle, but this is a brine that can produce at least 5 pints of pickled beets.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like maybe at least a few pounds of beets there, probably, that you'd be starting with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a 5-quart pot full of beets.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, Carol, thank you. Wow, I like the... couple of sticks of cinnamon in there.
Mm-hmm. Allspice. You had allspice and cloves.
Cloves.
Yes.
Which are both great, which are great additions to pickled beets.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
They make contrast with the white wine, though.
I don't know that we go with that.
Okay, now, don't know if we're going to put
Well,
that
a glass.
There.
You might have a glass of
okay,
wine with it.
You can drink the white wine.
Yeah, the wine could be right there.
Yeah.
Carol, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Candy in Walworth County, we'll go to you next.
Okay. I have a haiku.
Oh, wonderful.
All right.
It's for the watermelon, did you say?
Yes, it's for watermelon. Okay, hold on. It is watermelon rind, summer's leftover, fun bounty, pickled sweetness, yum.
Watermelon rind pickles. Is that what you were referring
to? Pickled watermelon rind. I love it.
Yeah, that is – what a wonderful dish. I wonder how many Wisconsin listeners are familiar with that. Where did you come up with pickled watermelon rind?
Oh, my grandmother would make it, and she lived up north, there were some Amish families, and they introduced her to it. And
Fantastic.
Then she was like, you have to try this. And I love to do it, and it's tasty. And yeah. I like to trick people because I'll serve it to them, but let them try and figure out what it is. The appearance is very gelatinous, and they're not sure, and, you know, poking it, and then they taste it, and they're like, this is delicious, and I'm like, it's really good.
It is so good.
It's fun.
I experienced it more in the southern United States than here in the Midwest, but it is a delicacy.
Really?
The watermelon rind pickle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Candy, you've done a great job on that haiku and on watermelon pickles.
I mean, these are actually kind of a wasted part of the vegetable that she has been able to turn into a delicacy
by
pickling it.
Isn't that beautiful?
Well, that's terrific.
Yeah, totally.
And it's not that hard to do. Really?
No, it's a
simple thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks again, Candy. Appreciate it very much. Well, you can join in, too, with your questions or comments. So we've had some recipes. We've had some haikus. We've had a few questions about vegetables. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, the Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, professors of horticulture at the UW-Madison. One of the fun things I like about this show is that this particular segment of Garden Talk is that we're talking about using vegetables and the wonder of vegetables and learning a little history about vegetables. And I think if that makes you want to spend a little more time preparing vegetables or growing vegetables. I think that's all for the good. I think that's all for the good. Robin in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Well, I just had to share my grilled squash recipe, summer squash recipe.
All right.
Because I actually grow the Zephyr Bicolor, which is kind of a zucchini Zephyr squash hybrid.
Yep.
Partly because I like the taste and partly because it looks so pretty in my garden.
Yeah, sure.
And what I do is instead of breading on any recipes, including macaroni and cheese, I use toasted quinoa.
Oh.
If you dry toast quinoa, it gets kind of a nutty smell to it. And I end up sprinkling that on top. But I make a mixture that has diced bell peppers, some diced leeks or scallions, a little bit of garlic, some diced tomatoes, some Romas out of the garden, and Parmesan cheese. I saute all the vegetables a little bit, mix in the Parmesan cheese with a beaten egg and some salt and pepper, and then I put that into my zucchini and sprinkle it then with the toasted quinoa.
Yeah.
And absolutely delicious. And, of course, As the summer squash comes in, I'm eating it a lot.
Well, yeah. And the thing about summer squash is the more you pick it, the more you get. If you pick it smaller, you're going to get more. Am I right about that, Jim?
It does appear that there is that particular phenomena does occur, yes.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. That's wonderful, Robin.
I'm kind of confused. Are you stuffing the zucchini?
Well, I cut the squash in half lengthwise.
And then you grill it.
I scoop out a little bit of that.
Yeah, okay.
And I'll mix that in with the sauteed vegetables. And then I do grill the zucchini.
Okay.
I can post the recipe on your Facebook page.
Go to send it to ideas@wpr.org.
Okay.
And we'll get a copy of it. Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it very much. Yeah, we'll get that. Let's go to Julie in Madison. Hi, Julie.
Hi, I have a couple of recipes or ideas about beets that I haven't heard mentioned, and one is when I can my beets, I boil them, skin them, then I put them in fresh water and heat them up again, and my water gets really, really red.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I use for my pickling liquid, because that keeps your beets really red while you store them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good
and
idea.
Then the other thing I do with beets, because my family loves them so much, is the big ones people aren't as interested in, but I buy those big ones, cook them, skin them, slice them really thick, like 3/4 of an inch.
Yep.
Salt, pepper, olive oil, and put them on the grill after you've cooked them.
Yes.
So they get the smoky flavor and finish them on the grill, and that's the best way to grill them.
Oh, that is beautiful.
You get the sugars, you get the beet flavor, and you get the smokiness.
You know, and it reminds me, I agree with you, and it's such a great way to do it. In Australia, it's quite common to find those kind of slices, those thick slices, on a burger. Much as we would put a tomato slice on a burger, people put a beet slice. And,
interesting.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a pickled beet slice, sometimes it's a grilled beet slice. But it strikes me as something that, you know, is virtually untapped, really, for an addition to a sandwich. But it is a great addition.
Yeah, wonderful. Julie, thank you so much.
With a little white wine, of course.
Yeah. What would that be called at McDonald's? What would that be? They'll call the McBeater?
A beta? How about a beta burger?
The beta? You know, that's not bad, Irwin. They could.
The beta burger?
The beta burger.
Mm-hmm.
Julie,
like
thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Leanne in Madison. Hi.
Hi. This is just a comment in response to the poems and actually appreciating all of the great recipes. There is a book and a poem by Stephen Dunning that was called Reflections on a Gift of Watermelon Pickle.
Oh, you're kidding.
You know, there is a tradition of poetry in this regard.
Oh, so that's beautiful.
And who is the author?
Peter
Stephen
Dunning.
Stephen Dunning. We're looking
Reflections on the Gift of a Watermelon Pickle.
Yeah.
And beautiful. It's kind of like, you know, that summer treat. So it was in the same vein as the haiku.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Leanne.
You know, I always thought it was only Neruda. Remember the great remember that years ago they let us read the Pablo Neruda poem. He wrote the Ode to the Tomato.
Do you have
Although
that?
It was a little violent. Oh, you know, we have it was it. Like thrusting the knife, you know, into the red, you know.
Jim, you should
flesh.
Read that again today.
That's a little frightening. But he also has Ode to the Artichoke, right? And so, I mean, I wonder why it's unfortunate that Neruda did not have, although Stephen Betting did write, you know, a poem about the watermelon. It's, think of Neruda, you know, that romantic Neruda writing Ode to the Watermelon Rind.
Well, here's the Ode to the Tomato. Would you like to, do you want to read it in,
it's a little violent,
read it in Spanish or do you
remember,
want to read it in
remember
English?
That in Spanish, like with plunging the knife into the flesh,
yeah,
you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
No, but I don't want to read the whole poem. I think the people can look it up. But in Spanish, it sounds a little bit better. But
Let me get it.
It was a little violent.
Pull
it up in Spanish.
Okay.
And we'll,
remember, we read it both in English and Spanish.
Well, we could do
on
a little.
The show. Although the ratings crashed. Why was that? I remember.
Oda al Tomate.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Isn't there the, where's the line where it talks about plunging the knife? Oh, llena de tomates, mediodía, verano, la luz se parte en dos mitades de tomate, corre por las calles, la sangre. Oh, no. No. Okay, no. I don't remember where the line is that talks about the, okay. It ends pretty nicely. Tiene luz propia, majestad benigna, venemos por desgracia en el cuchillo. And I don't know how to turn that. Or oh yeah, el cuchillo. Oh, this is the part that I, you know, that kind of frightened me.
Yeah.
Asesinarlo, se hunde el cuchillo en la pulpa viviente, es una roja víscera, un sol fresco profundo, inagotable. Well, that, I mean, he goes, and ladies and gentlemen, it goes on and on from there.
Well, what is it? Well, tell us what it means, though.
It's, he says, yeah, well, unfortunately, kind of we must murder it.
It's
the knife
Pablo,
sinks in.
You know, it wasn't one of his better days, you know, at dinner. And I can only imagine that he was, you know, like plunging
the knife. Sinks into living flesh.
I mean, plunging the knife
viscera.
Into the, you know, the visceral flesh of the tomato. It's a little, you know, it's a mental, I mean, this could be, if this were a haiku, it would be kind of frightening. You know? But if he did Ode, but imagine Neruda. And, you know, he wasn't very romantic in that one, which is also a little frightening. Because he's remember everything was about Matilde, right? His lady, right? And he used to write very romantically about her. But if he had done Ode to the Watermelon Rind, you know, I have to think about that.
Sinking the knife into the.
I don't want to think about the knife plunging into the.
Here is some beauty, though, that you read in that poem. Just the translation in English. He says the tomato invades the kitchen. It enters at lunchtime and takes its ease on the countertops, among the glasses, butter dishes, blue salt cellars. It sheds its own light, benign majesty.
The benign majesty was great.
Beautiful line. And then he says, unfortunately, we must murder it. The knife sinks into living flesh. Red viscera, cool sun. Anyway, it's a beautiful, I think benign majesty of a tomato sitting on your counter.
Well, see, the benign majesty I go for. Mm-hmm. After that, you know, it's a little frightening. And he did not, you know, if the tomato had been a root vegetable, think of him saying something like, light of the underground sky.
Yeah, right.
You know? Will emailed in about an old sweet potato that he forgot to eat. That sat in the corner of the kitchen for months. He ended up giving it a new life as part of his Japanese garden. And so here's what he has. Old sweet potato. Forgotten, grows roots, wife mad. Now planted, sweet beauty. Now there's a haiku. That's a pretty darn good haiku.
Saving the sweet potato.
I like the rescue aspect of that.
That's wonderful. Jim Nienhuis, one of our guests today. Jim is a professor of horticulture in the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. Irwin Goldman is a horticulture professor as well at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Always great to have them with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here talking vegetables today with our vicars of vegetables, Irwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis, both professors of horticulture in the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. And they do a lot of research on new vegetable cultivars. You may have some questions. We've been getting some recipes. We've had some haikus about vegetables and some other poems about vegetables. What's on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Kevin, thanks for waiting from Madison. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. At the beginning of the show, you guys made a couple comments about parsnips.
Mm-hmm.
I've got 12 acres south of Blue Mounds. I probably have enough wild parsnips on that property to put in every parsnip in every single grocery store in town.
Wow.
And I've read online that people actually do harvest the root of the wild parsnip, but you made a comment about them being toxic. I haven't had enough guts to harvest them yet, but I'm wondering, can you eat the wild parsnip root like a regular parsnip?
It is technically edible, the wild parsnip root, but I would urge extreme caution in every aspect of handling that plant. It is the exudate that comes from that plant that's very toxic. And there's a phytodermatitis. Your skin will get very irritated.
Blister. Right?
Blister,
It'll just blister your... And it makes you really sensitive to, like, sunlight. Like, if you...
That's right.
Yeah, it's very unpleasant plant to get around.
That's right. The photodermatitis issue, the sunlight will cause, in combination with those compounds, will cause your skin to blisters. Now, you can eat the root, technically, but I again, would be extreme. I mean, even getting at the root is going to require that you handle the plant.
Irwin, what is the origin of the wild parsnip? I mean, are these just feral? Or the parsnip is not native to the United States?
Right. It's not native. The parsnip is not native. Pastinaca comes from other parts of the world, but I believe that the parsnip escaped cultivation, and it is feral.
And so when it becomes in cultivation, we maintain it as with very low levels of these toxic compounds. Are these?
That's right.
But in the wild, it has to – I mean, this is one of the – this is kind of an allegory about the – you know, about plant domestication, in that we domesticate them to be – so that they're edible and wonderful and full of sugars, et cetera. But in fact, the plants require us in order to protect them from herbivory, right? From insects and fungi and
exactly.
bacteria. And when these plants go wild, they revert back to producing all of these toxic compounds that evolved with the plant to protect it from, right, from herbivory.
So well said. And so, you know, in fact, you could think about agricultural chemicals, pesticides, as our way of protecting those plants that we have selected for low levels of defense compounds.
I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of a sad story in a way. I mean, the wonderful thing about it is that we've created these plants, mm-hmm. except that we've created them so that they're completely dependent upon us.
Indeed.
Yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, the wild tomato. I mean, I remember when I worked in California, you know, in the tomato industry, I would drive I-5 and I-99 up and down California, and in all of the gutters, right, along the side of the road were the wild tomatoes. And, of course, there wasn't a burpy big boy growing mm-hmm. there. They were all like little tiny fruits.
Pea-like,
loaded with seeds. And the other thing is the interiors of them were almost always, you know, really pale or almost white, right? I mean, mm-hmm. one of the funny things at H.J. Heinz, we used to select very, you know, ferociously for uniform red color on the interior of the fruit. Because, you know, these pigments are all about light, light interception. So why would the plant have a pigment that's dealing with light interception on the inside of the fruit? Because as far as I can tell, it might be dark in there. So the plant, you know, has no need to have the carotenoids being produced on the inside of the fruit. The reason H.J. Heinz was so sensitive about it was because if you had any fruit, any tomato that tended to not have uniform color, if you made it was bad enough for the ketchup, but if you made any like chopped product or salsa, if you had those little white chunks, that was like immediate lawsuit because people would assume that those little white pieces, which were, you know, just tomato that wasn't pigmented with carotenoids, people would assume that those were, you know, just pieces a worm. They would always say that it was a worm. So they had to have people dealing with that. But they were, you know, you could prove that it was a tomato, mm-hmm. right? But you couldn't convince people that it wasn't a worm or
something
all the
else.
The odd things that went into tomato ketchup. I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. Non-tomato matter.
Yeah, they call it. The euphemistically referred to as NTM, right? Non-tomato matter. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, there were some odd things that went in there. Some of them were rodents.
On that note, we'll
okay,
move
okay, that's
to
a positive.
Anna.
You know, that's almost as bad a note as Neruda plunging that knife into the visceral tomato.
Anna in Franksville. Thanks.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Save me, Anna.
I don't think I'll ever eat a good tomato out of a can anymore, but okay.
You know, actually the canned tomato has a lot of benefits, actually, The odd thing is that the canned tomato is harvested ripe.
Right.
Right. I mean, it actually develops full color and sugars, whereas the tomatoes that are shipped to us right in the winter, they never develop the flavor compounds, you know, that.
No, they don't.
And so actually I'm a promoter of the canned tomato.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I bet you didn't call about canned tomatoes.
No, not today. I have a pickled beets recipe that I got out of a pudding food by book a long time ago. Married in 78, and you can figure out the years. But I have turned it into a refrigerator pickle.
Oh.
Instead of canning it, I use ice cream buckets with a lid, and I make the same kind of syrup you're going to use, equal parts vinegar and sugar. You can add more sugar if you don't like real sharp pickles.
Yeah.
And then to that I will add a cheesecloth bag with a teaspoon of whole allspice, 2 sticks of cinnamon, and 6 cloves. I boil that for 15 minutes. I leave the bag in there for flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, you processed your beets, you've cooked them, you peeled them.
Yeah.
And I slice them and put them in the bucket with the, and then I pour the hot liquid over the top. I leave that sit out until it's lukewarm. I put the lid on and I throw it in the fridge for maybe a week. My husband, or actually my brother-in-law, if he knows I have them, he'd be here the next day. But they're not quite as good as if you leave them for like a week. And then I will add beets to it as I...
As you go along.
As I go along,
so
yeah.
You maintain... Actually, your recipe allows you to maintain sort of a, you know, the integrity, the crispness of the vegetable, right?
Yes.
It's sort of like those Claussen pickles, right, that are not pasteurized.
The refrigerated pickle.
Right.
Yeah, the refrigerated pickle is, you know, that's really an amazing product. The trouble is that it requires refrigeration, right? But your recipe would allow you to maintain sort of the, you know, the texture, right, the crispness. So
yeah,
that's a great
wonderful.
Idea.
Wonderful. Thank you, Anna. Thanks.
You were talking about zucchini.
Yeah.
We have... roly-polies, sometimes you call them eight balls, depends on which company you get them from. But they're round zucchini.
Yep.
Last year, I was going through Pinterest, and I saw a recipe for for a zucchini pizza. And you cut the roly-polies, you grill them, or you fry them with just a little bit of oil, on both sides for maybe a minute and a half, and then you put them on a baking sheet, put your pizza sauce, and then you put whatever toppings you want, some cheese, you could put, and if you're going to use meat, you're going to want cooked meat.
Yeah.
So you're going to cook your sausage or just put pepperoni on there, whatever vegetables I shred and put on top, and then I put it in the oven for... It said to put it in there for like 15 minutes, and I thought it was too gushy, so I only leave it in for maybe 10 because I like a crunch to it.
So basically, what you're doing is you're substituting the, you know, the bread, right, part of the pizza. You're substituting a zucchini for that, a roly-poly.
Basically, it's low carb. If you don't use any kind of bread or carb. Now,
and basically anything that involves
carbs in it, but.
Yeah.
Anything that involves mozzarella cheese in abundance, you know, is going to be, I mean, stones, right? Old pieces of wood, right? Leaf litter, right? Anything that has mozzarella cheese, you're going to be able to consume,
so
right?
Yeah,
that's one. Anna, thank you very much. Well, that's one people are going to be able to find online as well. Craig... in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Quick recipe for zucchini or summer squash.
Okay.
We enjoy it year round. Is slice it up quarter inch, eighth inch. Some nice sweet onion fried up. Throw in the zucchini or the summer squash to whatever, you know, desired doneness you like. And then put some Parmesan cheese on top of it. Let it melt and... Just a quick vegetable for dinner.
All right. But you're sautéing the summer squash with onions.
Yes.
And then you're basically adding a little Parmesan cheese. No mozzarella on this one? Is there any possibility?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
kind of go for that, you know?
I usually put some Parmesan with... my asparagus, so I'm going to grill asparagus, a little oil and Parmesan.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And I roll it around in that. Okay. A friend of mine taught me that one. And if you're doing a boneless breast of chicken, the chicken and the asparagus get done at the same time.
Any possibility of white wine being included with this?
I always have some white wine with
okay,
it.
Okay.
Thanks, Greg. Norman in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Norman.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest what his suggestions are to get cantaloupe to ripen fully, because I live in central Wisconsin. I have big 5-6 pound cantaloupe. I like Athena as the brand Athena.
Yeah.
Cantaloupe.
Is that the cultivar?
Pardon?
Is that the cultivar name? I'm sorry. What was Athena?
Athena.
Okay.
Athena. A-T-H-E-N-A, yep. I believe. Anyway, they get fully formed, it seems, but they don't turn that nice yellow color, which and then separate at the stem end, indicating they're ripe. And they stay green, full size, for a month or so, and then often they start to rot, but they never get ripe. In other words, what is going on?
There's it's not a, you know, there's a reason why the muskmelon is not the state vegetable of Wisconsin, right? And that's because it's going to be tough to grow. You know, it is tough to grow here, even in Madison, you know, which you probably consider, you know, the banana belt, right? So it muskmelons, you know, these evolved in the Middle East, right? And this is like Iran, Iraq is the center of origin of these. So these plants are really evolved to adapt to, you know, long, sunny, hot weather. And we don't have that. You'll note that many of the muskmelons that we eat, you know, from the winter, they come from, you know, sunny climes. And we don't have that. We have cloudy days, so we don't get, we tend to have more cloudy days, so we don't tend to get the level of sugars that are, that would be normal in a muskmelon, right, grown in the field. And the ripening is also a, you know, a big problem because it's how do you figure out? I mean, you indicated two of the characteristics that you would use, right? One of them is called the slip, right, where the fruit will actually, you know, separate from the stem, and that's an indicator of maturity. Another indicator of maturity, I think that you referred to, was the fact that they will. You'll see on the bottom of the fruit, you'll see that they'll begin to produce carotenoids, right? They'll turn from green to yellow, and that's an indicating mm-hmm. if the carotenoids are being produced on the, yeah. you know, where the sun doesn't shine,
yeah.
right, on the bottom of the fruit, that's an indicator that the carotenoids inside the fruit, right, are being produced, and that's another indicator of maturity. The sad thing about the muskmelon also is that it's not like the, you know, it's some fruits will ripen off the vine, but the tomato, the muskmelon does not. I mean, basically the moment you detach it from the stem, that's it. That's as much sugar as it's going to get.
Which you call in horticulture terminology non-climacteric?
Non-climacteric, yeah. So they won't ripen off the vine. This is why one of the saddest things, there are two sad things in the vegetable store in Madison and Wisconsin in the winter. One is the pineapple
mm-hmm.
and the other is the muskmelon, because the pineapples are like gorgeous, like, oh my God, are they so beautiful? And then you think, what happened? Then you bite, you know, you cut open and you think, what happened? And then at Christmas time, you'll go into the grocery store and you'll buy those, you know, magnificent melons, right, that have been produced in, you know, Guatemala, right, that have been shipped up here. But, of course, they're harvested before they're mature, because if they harvested when they were mature, all you would get would be muskmelon sauce.
Yeah.
Right? So they ship up here and they never develop. They don't. It's not like a tomato you can spray with ethylene. And yeah. they will ripen. I mean, they will sort of ripen.
Yeah.
Right? They will do it. But muskmelons, you can't ripen off. They do not ripen off the vine. So.
So yeah, there's the problem, Norman.
Yeah. I don't want to. I've gone on and on. I'm sorry. It's. I know. I, too, love muskmelons. And, you know, I know that there are growers out there, you know, who I see muskmelons in their gardens. And I know that you can produce them in Wisconsin. But. It's going to be 1 year out of five, you know, that's going to provide, you know, the right climatic conditions, you know, like long summer hot days that are going to allow the sugars and the carotenoids to develop.
There you go, Norman. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Jim in Coon Valley. Jim, hello.
Okay, hold on just a minute. Now I can talk. Yes, I want to tell the guys about a happy accident that happened to me. Out of my own stupidity, I invented something.
Okay.
I planted some parsley, some Italian parsley, in a raised bed and had the parsley, and then got lazy and left some of the plants there. Learned that parsley is a biennial. It mm-hmm. came up the next year, made seed,
and made a root. Mm-hmm. And now I've got a raised bed that is, in effect, quote, a perennial parsley bed, because it just keeps receding.
Yeah, right. Receding.
The bonus is that the parsley root is one of the most magnificent flavors in beef, chicken, and vegetable stock.
Oh.
Agreed. And in fact, you know, Jim, the parsley root is another one of these vegetables that if you go to the Middle East or certain parts of Europe, people use it. And they use it in soup and they use it to make stock. You come here and nobody's ever heard of it or seen it. So you have hit on a real vegetable treasure that is something that people around here don't know much about.
And I don't have to buy seed.
Yeah, it's a beautiful system.
You got something good going there,
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, a lot of the other members of this family also reseed a lot. Dill will reseed a lot, mm-hmm. right? And even cilantro will reseed itself.
It's a beautiful system you've got.
thank you very much for calling and sharing it. Well, we had some haikus that were emailed. Karen emailed one. She called Eggplant Elegy.
That one is fantastic.
Really?
Jim, you're going to love this.
Is it positive?
Read that one.
Is there anything positive said about the eggplant?
No. It's quite negative, but it aligns,
great.
It aligns with your interests.
Okay.
Eggplant Elegy. Baked, fried, parmesaned, scalloped, or baba ganoushed, still tastes like a sponge.
Oh, I'm going to have to write that down because that's
accurate, right?
That is so accurate. Yeah. Remember the student in our class? I think I said some disparaging things. It was a rare moment for me. I said some disparaging things about the eggplant, and they said, no. You know, you've never tried eggplant parmesan, right? And they they brought it into class, right, the eggplant parmesan, and I went over to Menards, and I bought those – those 5 for 29 cents, you know, sponges. And I made Menard sponge eggplant parmesan tasted the same.
Nobody,
exactly the same.
No one could tell the difference.
No one could tell the difference. So she is right on.
Oh, garlic, pepper, yum. Tomato, apple, pear, plum. Earth rules and then some.
That's cute. That's really cool. That's cool.
Oh, and we had another one that is too long, but it's a poem from B.C. Lele. It's called "A Vegetable to Be Ready by the Parsnip." And on that note, if you want to look that one up, please do. Jim and Irwin, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much. I hope we have another chance to visit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Jim and...
kind of fun.
Yeah, Jim Nienhuis and Irwin Goldman, both professors in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison. Great to have them with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Just a look ahead on Monday, our physical therapists are back to talk about coping with pain after back surgery and, of course, answer all of your questions. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.